something does not go right, we establish a law, rule, or regulation to make it go right. After making things go right for a couple hundred years, we now have laws that govern everything. And that leads us to ask, are the laws we pass to make food safe biting the hands that feed us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned to the 1077th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Puerto Montt who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am your host here for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, Michael Olson. With me today, operating the good ship, Food Chain Radio, we have Jason Struby. Jason, good morning.
Honored to be here.
Quick question.
Yes.
Have you broken your fair share of laws yet this morning?
It's still pretty early, but I better plead the fifth.
Well, plead the fifth. Okay. Folks, consider Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. A few generations ago, most all of us lived very close to the source of our food, and we had a lot of control over what was in our food. Then we moved into the city. Those we left behind to grow our food moved 1,000 miles away to where it was easier to grow our food. In making the move into the city, we lost all control over what was in our food and therefore had to enact laws and establish rules and regulations to regain some control. We have been passing laws and making rules and regulations for many years and now have about 1,000 million billion of them on the books. While some of our laws make sense, others leave us to stare at the horizon, like the laws that constrain the sale of ugly fruits and vegetables, the laws that treat manure as a toxic waste, the laws that prevent the sharing of food with the homeless, the laws that prohibit people from growing fruits and vegetables in their own yards. Though we keep making more laws and rules and regulations, today we pause to ask, are the laws we pass to make food safe biting the hands that feed us? Here to help us consider the question, we have Balin Lineken, attorney and author of Biting the Hands That Feed Us. Balin, welcome.
Michael, thanks for having me on.
Good to have you aboard. You're in D.C., Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, just outside in Bethesda, Maryland.
Good. That's where every rule and law in the land starts, I guess, and so it's a good place to start our conversation. You're a food attorney. What exactly does a food attorney do?
A whole host of things. I have friends who represent small food entrepreneurs and farmers and help them do everything from wills, trusts, and estates to farm sales to regulatory and labeling stuff. I know people who work for big giant food companies. I teach at a law school, a food law and policy seminar that's sure. increasingly popular at law schools around the country.
George Mason University, yeah. And what do you teach? You teach about food law?
Yeah, it's called Food Law and Policy. It's a seminar. I have 16 students, and we focus on USDA and FDA regulations, of course, but also restaurants, food trucks, things that are sort of outside of the federal purview, local food, cottage food laws, ag gag laws, sustainability, things like that.
All of those wonderful things. Well, you must have had some kind of epiphany moment when you realized that you just had to write a book entitled Biting the Hands That Feed Us.
I did. I mean, I've been writing about these issues for many years. I write a weekly column for Reason Magazine's website, and I've spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of people, many of them small producers who, for one reason or another, have been essentially handcuffed, sometimes literally, by the government when they try to produce and sell sustainable foods at farmers markets and in groceries and elsewhere. So it was just sort of the I had gathered a mountain of evidence, which I think I present in a hopefully an enjoyable fashion in the book, and you know, something that I think it's a different perspective that people often don't hear.
Well, you most certainly do present it that way, and it's a great read, so pick it up enjoy it as I have. Laws, rules, and regulations. You know, civil liberties attorney Harvey Silverglate makes the incredible assertion that the average person breaks three felony laws a day. And holy smokes, we don't even know sometimes that we're doing that. But over the years, we have, you know, established so many laws and so many rules and so many regulations. I thought we'd pause for a moment and first ask, what's the difference between a law and a rule and a regulation?
Sure. Now that's a wonderful place to start. And I'll add policy to that mix too. A policy is sort of a statement of aspirations. It's make food safer, reduce obesity, keep kids safe, promote local food. It's any sort of aspirational thing that embodies what something that we as a society may want to occur. But, you know, you can wave a magic wand and say reduce obesity. You can advocate for it, or you can pass a law perhaps designed to do that. And so the law activates the policy. It gives it meaning and gives it a direction. And in most cases, the laws that we pass are not simply, you know, you pass the law and that's done. In many cases, a rule or a regulation. And in the book, I sort of couch everything as a rule just for ease of language. But a regulation is what actually operationalizes the law. So the law might say, give every American fresh fruits and vegetables, but which fresh fruits and vegetables, which vegetables are fresh? The rules, the regulations are the things that are going to just, you know, describe exactly what, which vegetables, how much fruits, which ones may be excluded, the timing, how much they actually, et cetera. The key details are the things that are found in the regulations.
Mm-hmm. Well, all of them, the laws, the rules, and the regulations have consequences. Some consequences are intended, others are unintended. Is anybody in charge of keeping track of which is which and the impact of laws and rules and regulations?
Well, in theory, we elect lawmakers, and they're supposed to keep track of these things. And if a law has some unintended consequences, either due to the law itself or to the regulations, they're supposed to either amend or repeal that law. This is essentially what we're paying them for as taxpayers. And likewise, people in agencies, whether federal agencies like the FDA or the USDA, or in state health departments or local health departments, they're also supposed to be monitoring the impact of the regulations they enforce, and ideally they'll themselves report to legislators if those regulations and or laws aren't working.
Mm-hmm. So if everything's working as intended, and if the intentions were good, then things kind of just keep sailing right along. But if the unintended consequences pop up and really make things foul things up, then people start squawking and raising heck and going to their congressmen and so on, and things work their way up the food chain and they change them, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's that's the sort of the stylized, the idealized thing that we've just described, you know, how things should work. But then, of course, there are how things actually work. And, you know, every sort of law that is passed that doesn't work is typically characterized as simply, you know, we're not doing enough of X. And so typically the agency, let's say the FDA, will say, you know, we're trying to enforce this law with our rules, but really we need more money to do it. It's more funding. Failure is evidence of the need for more money. Success also is the evidence for the need for more money. And that's sort of the way things work in the real world.
Everything is a reason for more money, right?
Yes, on the part of government agencies, small and large, yes.
Okay, well, you know, they say there are two things that we shouldn't watch being made. One is sausage and the other is laws. And you kick off your book kind of with both. the sub-making of sausage and the making of a law. And so when we get back, I'd like to take this opportunity to see how both are made, sausage and laws. Folks, this is a Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We have Balan Linikin with us. He's the author of Biting the Hands That Feed Us, How Fewer, Smarter Laws Would Make Our Food System More Sustainable. Do you think it possible to have fewer and smarter laws? Well, that's going to be the end conversation here today. We have to fish that answer out from Balan. How can it be possibly have fewer and smarter laws when everybody and everything wants us to have more complicated laws, or so it seems? This is the Food Chain Radio program. How do the laws impact your business as a farmer, as a food consumer? 831-479-1080. Feel free to join us. Pick up your phone and go for it.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Hello out there. Have you broke your fair share of laws today? Civil liberties attorney Harvey Silverglate suggests that each of us, being average, will break 3 felonies every day. And so have you broke your fair share today? I don't know if I have, which is kind of frightening because they might throw me in jail and throw all of us in jail, except there's no jail that big. Question for our guest today, who is the author of Biting the Hands That Feed Us, the laws and how the impact they have on our ability to feed ourselves, Balan Linikin. Balan, I got a phone call some time ago from an ag attorney, and he said, did you see the letter? And I said, no, what letter? And he said, a letter from the Brand X large grower shipper company. And I said, no, what did it say? And he said, it said, if local food is taking a bite out of your profit, join us in Washington, D.C. While you being in Washington, D.C., I'm just curious, what on earth could a big grower shipper organization do to prevent small farmers at the farmers market from taking a bite out of their profit?
Well, they could do 2 things, one of which I would applaud and the other of which I would not applaud. One is to try to compete with them, to grow more food locally and to sell more food locally.
How would they do that in Washington, D.C.?
That's a good question. And that leads into the thing that I would not prefer, which is that they would come to Washington, D.C. to lobby for regulations, laws that would favor them over their smaller competitors, which is what largely the second chapter of my book on big food and big government and how they work together is focuses on.
Well, and that's where, let's go right now. You kind of open your book, Biting the Hands That Feed Us, with a story of sausage making in Denver.
Yeah, it's and as you very rightly pointed out, law and sausage making are 2 things that we've been told that we don't want to see. And I think it's probably far more true. I've seen sausage making in action, and the result is handsome and tasty. I think lawmaking rarely has that sort of handsome and tasty outcome. So the story that that begins the book pertains to Mark Donitis, who is a he taught for a decade at Johnson & Wales, which is a leading culinary education center for young chefs. And he taught meat cutting and food safety. He was served in the American Lamb Board. I mean, he's a, you know, he's a, an expert.
The professional's professional.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, you come to him when you want to be educated about meats from sort of food safety to food quality. So he took his decades plus of knowledge, and he had been doing these sorts of things before. His family is Italian immigrants. He took all his knowledge and he opened up a sausage maker, Salumi, Salumeria, which sells, you know, hard muscle meats, things like pepperoni, salami, and some other interesting varieties. And he and a partner opened this up. It's called Il Mondo Vecchio, which translates in Italian as the old world. And so he used old world methods, and he created wonderful hard muscle meat sausages and whatnot that consumers loved. He won the Colorado Restaurant Association's Best Newcomer Award. He was nominated for Eater's Top Chef in Colorado. The Bravo, the network that airs Top Chef, referred to him as, quote, the sausage king. And the Denver Post said that he had made Denver a special place for old world meats.
So it's kind of like the it's kind of like the ultimate local food boy makes good.
Absolutely. And he was sourcing all of, you know, in addition to all that sort of backstory, he was sourcing his ingredients from, you know, he got his salt that he used, and he had, he told me back in 2012 that he only had four ingredients. It was sea salt, spices, quality meat, and thyme, T-I-M-E. So, you know, he was light on ingredients, high on quality. He, in addition to the salt, he sourced his heritage pork from Cure Organic Farm in Boulder, which is a biodynamic farm, certified organic, that, that only sells within, I think, 50 miles of the farm. You know, from a sustainability perspective, he was doing, and a quality perspective, he was doing everything right.
Kind of stuff you'd like to eat.
Yeah, I mean, this guy, he's a, you know, he is a poster boy for, you know, whether you want to call it the good food movement or the local food movement, you know, he was a star. And all his food had been inspected, as food must be, by USDA inspectors who were on site whenever he was making his sausage and other foods.
So he had he actually had people watching over his shoulder while he's making the foods.
Yeah, and this is the case with anyone who sells commercially any sort of meat products in this country. Slaughter and processing must be overseen by a USDA inspector on site, and he, you know, he passed all the tests. He had private certifications and other things that that he had done. You know, he was a stickler for food safety. There are photos of him online. You can see he's wearing a hairnet over his beard, to, you know, and he's got a blue hard hat on, and latex gloves and a white lab coat. I mean, he looks like he he's about to perform surgery. And this was all great, but at one point the USDA inspector told him that he had to add nitrates or nitrites to his food because the USDA had sort of changed its interpretation of its regulations and decided that that this was necessary. And he used, you know, his company was Il Mondo Vecchio, the old world. He used old world methods, and that was not common in the old world. And he said, well, no, I don't want to do that.
Was there a complaint? Was there a food safety complaint against him?
No, never. Not one ever.
So it was just a reinterpretation of the laws.
Exactly.
We've been doing the things this way, and now we decided to do things this way, and you're in trouble.
Exactly. It's a classic case, which I detail in other examples in the book, of federal, particularly federal, but oftentimes state and local regulators are requiring some sort of rigid process rather than rewarding people who achieve good outcomes.
And what happened?
And Well, he was given a choice either to pay tens of thousands of dollars for something called a challenge study, which would prove ostensibly that his food was safe, even though, you know, a year of testing had obviously shown that. Or he could add nitrates and nitrates, or unfortunately, the third option he was given, and this is what he chose, was to simply go out of business. Because he had built this business on principle, you know, the old world. Mm-hmm. And if he couldn't do things the way that he felt his customers wanted, then he wasn't going to do it at all.
So instead of capitulating and doing things the way, adding nitrates and nitrosamines, right? Instead of adding that which few people suggest we eat, he did it the old way, which is the way we've always done it up till very, very recently. And so he just said, to heck with it, I'm out of here. Yeah. And we've lost that local food down.
Exactly. It's, nitrates and nitrates are naturally occurring substances. They occur in things like celery roots. Mm-hmm. And people like chefs and cookbook authors like Michael Ruhlman say that they're fine to use. Some people claim that they get headaches or other things from eating foods that contain them. Wine is the sort of the, you know, classic example. Sure. Of people who avoid it. And, you know, people should be free to use them or not to. And the USDA was telling this one chef that he was not free to
create
safe food without them.
Well, we've learned all about making sausage. Now let's learn about making laws. And specifically, let's learn how the Food Safety Modernization Act was passed and the implications of that law on the hands that feed us, which is the subject today. The impact that the rules and laws and regulations we make have on those people who produce our food. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, here with Balin Lineken and you, 831-479-1080. Welcome back, folks. We're making law and we're making sausage. And though you often don't want to see either one of them made, that's what we're doing today. We're watching them being made. Before we move on to watching how laws are made with respect to the Food Safety Modernization Act, I'd like to take Balin back to the last segment in which we were talking about how his friend in Colorado was making sausage in the old world way. And then all of a sudden, the Food and Drug Administration, or was it the FDA or the USDA, one of the two, reinterpreted a law or a regulation and said, yeah, we were doing it this way, and now we decided to do it this way. Do they have that freedom to suddenly reinterpret all of these laws and rules and regulations at their whim, Balin?
I think you can make a very, very good legal argument that they don't. But, you know, you mentioned earlier, at least once in the show, that, you know, most people commit at least three felonies a day. Harvey Silverglade had, mm-hmm. Had said that. And, you know, a felony is in the eye of the beholder, and the beholder is a police officer or other person. And if you think about how many people are charged with crimes who are found not guilty because they actually didn't commit the crime, that's just a case of, you know, interpretation or misinterpretation by a government actor, in this case, a police officer, for example. And they're no more or less fallible than a USDA or an FDA or a state health department employee.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like, though, that if you are interpreting a law this way and understands that everybody understands that you're interpreting it this way, it's okay to do things in the old world way as long as you're clean. And we're going to watch you and make certain that you're clean. And it goes on that way, and you build a world around that principle. And then it seems arbitrarily somebody comes in and says, nah, we've changed our mind. We're going to do it this way. Now you have to do it the new world way, which is to use nitrosamines and nitrates. I mean, is that arbitrariness? Is it legal?
I would certainly, and I generally am not a practicing attorney in the sense that I'm representing clients, so I'm not, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not hauling anyone into court tomorrow, and I'm certainly not offering legal advice, but you know, from a, in my perspective, I think that when you've been doing something one way, and the government tells you that that's fine, and then they tell you that it's no longer fine, then you certainly have a case for the sort of arbitrary and capriciousness of the government's new interpretation versus the old one. I think that's a wonderful argument.
Well, okay. Let's move right along to the making of law. Of course, one of the sayings we've become very familiar with in recent years is that one should never let a serious crisis go to waste. And that kind of points to the development of the Food Safety Modernization Act, which began, as I understand it, because of a few contaminations, mass contaminations. It began, I think, with spinach, spread to peanuts, a few other things. A lot of people got sick a very short period of time. The government stepped in and said, we're going to pass laws to make food safe. And they did. And did they make food safe?
Well, that is the multi-million dollar question. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I detail this in the book, that the laws are effectively not making food safer. And because of that, you know, where am I obtaining my data? I'm actually obtaining it from the FDA, which is the agency that is empowered to enforce the Food Safety Modernization Act and has drafted the rules. Which are now in place. So there are two key rules, one of which governs good manufacturing practices not on the farm, and then another one that governs produce safety on the farm. And the FDA estimates together that these are going to make our food somewhere between 1% and 3% safer if they're implemented to perfection.
Wait a minute. The government itself says the Food Safety Modernization Act will make our food 1% to 3% safer?
The two key rules, the ones that are supposed to have the most bang for the buck, yes, are going to make our food at best negligibly safer, and are going to cost you know, everyone, taxpayers and others, hundreds of millions of dollars, and small farmers and producers somewhere at least $5,000 to $10,000 a year. In new fees and charges and processes.
Well, let me ask you this. For whom will the Food Safety Modernization Act make food safe? Will it make food safe for, as you said, 1% to 3% more safe for us consumers? But who among the producers of food will the Food Safety Modernization Act make food safe?
Well, the law was supported by food safety advocates, including the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and large national food companies.
Mm-hmm.
They are you know, many of the processes that this law mandates are ones that they're already using. So it was no, you know, additional skin off their back. I'm talking about the food producers, and so they supported it because, you know, this is a way to sort of codify the practices that they're already engaging in. And also it's one that does make it difficult, or in some cases impossible, for their smaller competitors to comply with. And I'm talking about local farmers, small food entrepreneurs, CSAs and others.
Is this an example of what that letter I brought up earlier was referring to? If local food is taking a bite out of your profits, join us in Washington, D.C., and we'll pass the Food Safety Modernization Act. Something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I like to say that, you know, there's no, I don't even know that letter necessarily is a smoking gun. There are decisions that are made in dark, smoky rooms, and I've never been invited into those rooms. So I can only go on sort of what, you know, what common sense and data, suggest. And I think that, yeah, I think that the letter that you're referring to is exactly the sort of thing, where large companies are trying to squeeze out their smaller competitors in the food arena.
Okay. And then, of course they are. And of course, small farmers are trying to compete with big farmers. And competition is what makes all of our lives better, because to survive, you have to get better. But in thinking and considering, you know, the effort to make laws in Washington, D.C., got to wonder about the role of money and who has the money to make the laws. Because as we see in, you know, the current election cycle, there's a lot of money being put forward, and who has that money. So when we come back, I'd like to talk about, continue our discussion about the making of law, and ask about the impact of money and who has that money and the role economies of scale plays in the making of law with respect to money and law and lawmakers. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. You know, today we're talking with attorney and author of Biting the Hands That Feed Us, Balan Linnikin. How fewer, smarter laws can change to make it easier for us to have a more sustainable agriculture, a more sustainable way of feeding ourselves. Do stay tuned. Well, here's a question for you. Biting the Hands That Feed Us. How fewer, smarter laws would make our food system more sustainable? How do we get to the point where we can have fewer, smarter laws when money is a big part of what makes laws? And Balan, I have an economies of scale question for you. You know, let's say we have two farmers. Farmer Bob has an acre of land. Farmer Sue has 1,000 acres of land. And let's say both of them decide to have a law passed, and it will cost like $10,000 to get the attention of their favorite lawmaker. $10,000. Probably not much in today's currency, but for Farmer Bob with 1 acre of land, that's $10,000. But Farmer Sue with 1,000 acres, that's only $10 an acre. So Farmer Sue is going to have find it pretty easy to contribute that $10,000 to the lawmaker, where Farmer Bob, not so much. So obviously, who's going to have sway in Washington, D.C., are those organizations that have the economies of scale to be able to, well, I don't know what you call, you know, contributing to a politician. How do we overcome that?
No, that's a great question. And so one example that I can think of that's really on point in my book, I discuss farmers market regulations in Mississippi. And, you know, the term farmers market contains the word farmers in it. So you think that this market is somehow intended to benefit, amongst others, farmers along with consumers. And yet the regulations pertaining to sales of meat, steaks and other things at farmers markets in Mississippi say that if you're going to sell, you need to either own or lease a refrigerated vehicle to transport, whether you're selling one steak or 1,000. And most people aren't selling 1,000 steaks at a farmer's market. You need to drive the steaks to that farmer's market in a refrigerated truck. In the back of the truck, you have to have the refrigeration unit on throughout the travel. You have to have it on throughout the period of the farmer's market, and you have to sell the steaks out of the back of that truck. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't have a refrigerated truck, and if I'm going to travel someplace with some meat, I generally use ice packs or ice in a chest or a cooler, and it works great. It makes sure that the temperature of the steaks is kept at 40 degrees or below, which is the 40 is the temperature at which food safety issues can arise. But it's far less costly. You're talking about economies of scale. For a farmer, a small farmer who just wants to sell a handful of steaks at a market, to, you know, fill up a chest with some ice and some steaks and bring it to the market, than it is for them to buy a $100,000 refrigerated truck. If you're a large producer then, or a seller, then that refrigerated truck is, you know, a drop in the bucket and makes perfect sense for you. But
and you also, but you're also, if you have a lot, you're not selling it just locally, you're selling it away. You know, you're selling in distance.
Right, yeah. You might drive around the state and go to 3 farmers markets, or you're going to sell to a grocery or to a butcher or to a larger seller.
Right.
And, you know, it's wonderful that those sorts of choices, whether from a large or a small farm, exist. But in Mississippi, you don't have the choice to buy meat from a small farmer because, at least at a farmer's market, because there aren't any, from what I hear.
And again, you know, it's a great example of how we used to live very close to our food and have control over that food. But when we move for great distances away, we establish rules and regulations to govern that food. But why do we have to have rules and regulations for food? You know, why do we have to use the same regulations for food that comes from China to buy food from our next door neighbor? Does that make sense?
It doesn't. I heard you had an advertisement for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund,
right.
Joel Salatin talking, and you know, Salatin is a hero of mine. He also very kindly offered a blurb in the jacket of my book, and I'm also a fan of the work of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, and I applaud their efforts in the book. And they make a very compelling case, I think, that these sort of direct to consumer sales, such as are now legal for the most part, except for beef and pork in the state of Wyoming, where they passed a Food Freedom Act a year ago. Yeah, these sorts of sales where you have a consumer who's educated about any potential risk right on the food label and can make up their own mind. And they can go down the street, you know, to their neighbor's farm and buy something if they want to, or buy it at a farmer's market, raw milk, whatever. That's absolutely something that should be legal, and I certainly make that argument.
Well, it should be legal, but those who have money have gone to Washington, D.C., and passed laws that make it impossible, or if not Washington, D.C., but to state capitals or county governments, and those who do not have the economies of scale don't have the wherewithal to fight those regulations. So the question I'm going to put to you when we come back for our final segment is that how do we find a way to have fewer, smarter laws that would make our food system more sustainable? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here with Balin Linnikin. And, of course, you too, because this affects everybody that eats food or grows food or processes food. How can we have fewer and smarter laws that would make our food system more sustainable when everything is aligned against doing just that? Right back. Please do stay tuned. We have some crazy laws on the books, laws that constrain the sale of ugly fruits and vegetables, laws that treat manure as toxic waste, laws that prevent the sharing of food with the homeless, laws that prohibit people from growing fruits and vegetables in their own yards. Sounds really crazy, but you know, I'll bet to somebody those laws make a lot of sense because they keep a lot of product off the market, keep the price high, and constrain competition. So how do we get rid of the crazy laws and have fewer, simpler laws that make our food system more sustainable? Balin Linnikin wrote the book, Biting the Hands That Feed Us. Balin, how are we going to do this?
That's a wonderful question, and it's one that I do address in the book. My argument is effectively that we do have all these laws either that promote unsustainable food practices, farm subsidies being a terrible example of that, or laws that prohibit people from engaging in sustainable food practices, as I detail. And as you mentioned earlier, you have laws that prohibit people from sharing food with the homeless, from growing food in their front yard, from having a handful of hens to lay eggs in their backyard. And these laws are patently ridiculous and outrageous.
But they're not if you're a big operator. and you're trying to keep all of these little people from competing with you, the laws make perfect sense.
Right, but that's not the purpose of law, and it never should be. Companies should never be protected from competition by anyone. This is what, the thing that makes America great is that we have people of all different sizes and abilities competing against one another.
But if we call it food safety, doesn't that make a difference? We're going to make food safe for you? Doesn't that make a difference then?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like I said before, if we're mandating good outcomes, if we're mandating that people not sell food that contains harmful bacteria, or that they keep their food chilled below 40 degrees Fahrenheit to make sure that food is in fact safe, we don't need to really do anything else. We, can require some basic food labeling and let everyone have at it. The government should weed out the bad actors and ones who actually are sickening or potentially sickening people. So food safety regulations aren't inherently bad, but so many on the books, as I detail and as we discussed, don't make our food safer, and they simply squeeze out the little guy, and that's wrong.
Well, it's wrong, but unless you're a big guy, then it's right. So how do you limit the ability of those who enjoy the economies of scale from buying government?
Well, I think that lawsuits and litigation are certainly one tool, but I think that, the Constitution, I think, protects people of all sizes who want to engage in an honest living and sell things and produce things. And I think that there are ways to litigate against such people. And I think that also people should demand of their lawmakers that they stop catering to the whims and wishes and iron fist in many cases of larger food producers. There's nothing inherently wrong with a large food producer. The problem is, as you just described, is when they come and they use the law to prohibit their smaller competitors from succeeding.
Baylen Linnikin, attorney and author of Biting the Hands That Feed Us. Thank you so much for joining us, Baylen. Folks, well, remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.